So is Dvorak really better than the QWERTY keyboard layout? What the heck does that even mean? Will it make you a better programmer? Or, I don't know, even prevent RSI? We're not doctors, but we'll talk about it.
Is it right that VS Code is as popular as it is? Or should everybody convert to Emacs or NeoVim?
That's a great question. And should we also learn Rust? I mean, I think
yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you have it. Let's get into the show. Welcome to the React Show, brought to you from occupied Miwok territory by your hosts, Thomas and Evan. Thank you for joining us. I'm so excited to have Evan co-hosting with me today. Thank you for joining us on the show again, Evan. Great to have you.
Hey, Thomas. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited. And I heard that you've actually been using the Dvorak keyboard layout. Is that right?
Is there any other keyboard layout to use?
I mean, I use QWERTY. You know, it's like the standard one that most people use. But I have heard that Dvorak is what I should be using. So I'm curious, would you agree? Well, why should I use Dvorak?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call QWERTY a keyboard layout. It's maybe something else. So just kidding. I like Dvorak. I'm pretty new to it. It's been a few months. I like it because it seemed to be designed for typing in a way that minimizes hand movement. And it also seems like, you know, there's a lot of vowels on the left hand and then a lot of consonants on the right hand. It seems to flow more naturally. So like, I don't know. I really like it. It kind of helps so that I'm not moving my fingers in a weird way.
And so is that like kind of like you can alternate between right and left because it's like consonant, vowel type of thing?
Yeah, I think part of the design intended for this thing, you'd say like rolling. So it'd be like, you know, if you're kind of moving your fingers in a manner that's like more in a flow instead of like kind of awkward. I mean, you do some stuff. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So I guess before we like talk more about it, could you like fill people in with like what actually is a keyboard layout? Like I think most people are using the, you know, QWERTY non-layout, as you call it, but they use a QWERTY-based keyboard, right?
Yeah.
And that's where like the upper left is Q, then W, E, R, T, Y, and that's what people are used to typing on. So can you just like, I don't know, tell us what Dvorak is and how it's different than what people are used to?
Sure. So yeah, I was obviously joking about the QWERTY thing not being keyboard layout. Yeah, basically, you can, on certain programs or with certain keyboards, you can program each individual key to kind of be whatever you want it to be. And most people just kind of take for granted, like, okay, this is how a keyboard's laid out. So Dvorak was a keyboard layout that was invented, I think, in the 1920s or 30s, and it was named after the person who invented it, I think. So I'm not an expert.
Classic.
Yeah. But I guess the QWERTY layout was designed for typewriters to try to actually slow you down so that you're not making errors and causing issues when you're using a typewriter. And so the Dvorak keyboard layout was came around later on after that, when that wasn't a concern, to try to like, you know, make the layout more intended for like how people are going to be using keyboards.
So are you saying that the actual like order of the keys on the keyboard are different? That's like,
yes, definitely.
And the difference is Dvorak is supposedly based on some sort of more optimal layout. I'm curious, like, do you know anything about like where QWERTY came from, like why that is a layout?
Oh yeah, I mean, I kind of mentioned it. Basically the extent that I know is that it was intended to, at least one of the main points was to not have you typing too quickly, so that it was, if you were typing quicker, I think it would cause the typewriter to like have an issue. So,
really? Yeah. Interesting.
That's what I heard. I don't know. Have you heard that?
Cause I don't actually know, but yeah. I'm interested though now. do you feel like you type better in some way on Dvorak?
Yeah, so...
Really? How so?
When I say better, so for me, the whole QWERTY thing was... So I was not just using QWERTY, I was also doing a bunch of keyboard combinations to like change apps on my computer and do different things like that with my left hand. And so I was getting some wrist discomfort. So I was looking into like different ways to minimize that. And someone mentioned the Dvorak keyboard layout. And I actually was doing a bunch of research and I saw some videos of like a picture of someone typing, like their hands typing Dvorak next to someone typing QWERTY. To show you, like, and it looked like the QWERTY person was moving their hands a lot more, and the Dvorak was kind of staying on what you'd call like the home row more, and it was less movement. And so it seemed to be like maybe better for your wrists a little bit.
Okay. So basically, with Dvorak, you feel like your wrists are moving less.
Yes.
That makes sense. Does it, do you feel like it has made you type faster or more accurately or anything like that?
Well, technically I'm slower with Dvorak. Like, I'm new to it. Uh-huh. So it's still like something I'm practicing. Like I'll practice like most days, just a little bit of just typing practice. So in the short run, obviously it's slowed me down because I've had to like learn, it's almost like learning a new language a little bit. Like you just have to kind of get the muscle memory. But I will say I feel like the typing is much more elegant. Like I feel like, okay, I'm not doing these weird movements. It's like, okay, when I'm typing this word, it seems to flow. Like there's almost a level of symmetry with how some of the letters are laid out and some of your hands, you know, the hand movements. It's almost like, oh, this is a beautiful layout. So
you're kind of saying it's like the difference between me writing some poetry and you're reading that versus reading Shakespeare's poetry. One just sort of flows naturally and has a symmetry to it, and one doesn't, right?
I like that analogy. Yeah, like, you like that? Poets. But I've never read your poetry, Thomas. Maybe you're like quite the poet. You're just, if you're as much of a poet as you are a Lisp programmer, then Shakespeare, right?
You know, I program in Lisp sonnets, so. Okay. Not really, but you know, we can all pretend. It's interesting. I'm curious now, do you use like do you just like type on your laptop, like sitting on your lap, or like what is your setup beyond like using the Dvorak keyboard layout?
Yes, this is where it gets more interesting. I use a custom keyboard that it's not just any custom mechanical keyboard, it's like a DIY keyboard. It's called the Ferris Sweep.
Sounds fancy. What's the difference between that and like this mechanical keyboard that I have sitting here? That's maybe, you know, it's a custom mechanical keyboard, but it's pretty standard, you know, layout. Is it similar to that, or is it special in some other way?
I wish I had it with me. It's in my like vehicle, but it's basically a split keyboard. So it's,
okay.
You would have to order the components and build it yourself. Or like in my case, I had a guy on Etsy build it for me, but it's basically laid out. The keys are laid out in columns. I think it's only like 38 keys or something. So it's basically you have three rows of five keys.
Oh,
and then you have two thumb keys on each.
Oh my, you're in deep.
Yeah. So there's no, like your pinkies can't go anywhere. So
okay,
like, for me, that was a big issue, is like, I don't want to use a left shift key or a right shift key on my pinky ever. So,
I think my keyboard has, I forget, it's like 70 keys or something, 80 keys. I don't know, right? That's pretty normal, right? What you're saying, yours only has like what, 30 something?
Yeah, I think so. If you do the math, so it'd be 10 times 3, so that's 30 plus I think it's only 34 keys.
Well, how, so does that mean it doesn't have like number keys? And
that's
like,
right. So the way you would do that, it runs this open source firmware called QMK.
Yeah, that's what this runs.
Okay. So you can program it to, like, I have it set up for like the outer thumb keys are both spaces. But when you hold either of those, it becomes the shift key.
Okay. Yeah. So it's basically like you're making more of the keys multi-purpose or multi, what do they call it? Like multimodal or something.
Mm-hmm. And you can also toggle like a layer shift, let's say. So if
you hold
the inner thumb key, that becomes the numbers and symbols and arrows. So
yeah. So like on this keyboard, I don't have the function row or like an escape button. And the reason why I actually use those buttons and I like them, but I've been traveling on my bicycle and so more compact was just really important to me. And so I programmed the function key to do different things when I hit the other keys. So like the tilde becomes an escape character when I'm hitting the function key. So it sounds like you're using a keyboard that sort of takes that to the next level and makes even more things based on like layers or modes. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, fascinating. I didn't know that. So not only do you have the Dvorak layout, but you also have a pretty specialized keyboard. I'm curious, like separate from the Dvorak layout, how do you feel about your keyboard?
I mean, I love it. I did a lot of research because there's a lot of different keyboards like and keyboard layouts you could go with.
Yeah.
One thing that I also do is I tilt it. It's called tenting. I tent it to like almost 90 degrees. So
you are all the way in. I like it.
So, cause like I tried typing flat and I still had some wrist, and I was reading that like the most natural position for your wrist is as if you're shaking someone's hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yep. Kind of like, I have this mouse that's shaped like that. And I noticed for a long time I've been using this mouse and I don't need like any sort of wrist pad or anything. I can just have my hand flat on the table and I never have pain in my right hand from that. So I tried to emulate that with the keyboard as much as I could. And I think, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. So it sounds like you like it.
Yeah, that's right. I like it. So I got low profile keys. I'd say one thing that I'm still curious about is, one thing I do like about Mac keyboards is that they're really low profile, so you don't have to move your hand very much, your finger. Mm. The only...
I hate that.
Really? Okay, because to me, I can go so much faster with it, but the downside is I'm more likely to... Like, I think it requires a little more force, so you have to, like, put a little... And, like, sometimes I find myself kind of pressing hard.
Yes, that's why... That's mainly why I don't like it. Well, that and there's, like, no feedback to let me know that I actually push the key down, you know? But
So I really like... I mean, I like the keyboard, but there's another thing called the Caracorder. Have you heard of that by chance?
Is it, like, a corded keyboard?
Yeah, but it uses these little joysticks.
So
I'd be really interested... I actually bought one, but I discovered it shortly after I was exploring this Ferris Sweep thing, so I ended up just returning it for now because it was too much for me to learn both at the same time.
Yeah.
But I'd be really curious about that because that seems like it takes the speed to the next level and you don't have to...
Right.
Not just only pressing your finger in, like, one direction. You can, like... do multiple directions at once. And
I've looked into a lot of this and like the corded keyboards and stuff, which if you're not familiar with that, it's basically taking what Evan was saying in terms of like layers or modes and making it even more extreme, right? So like there might be like four or five different layers and it might even allow you to type, you know, multiple characters with one key press or something, you know? So essentially you could type really, really fast. I think that's the general idea, right? Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay. So I've looked into this and I've looked into Dvorak and all of this. And I think the reason why I haven't switched is more to do with, at least when I'm programming, I don't feel like I'm spending that much time typing. And so I'm like wondering, is it worth all of my time learning a new system for what feels like not a big benefit? On the other hand, you know, when I'm doing a lot of writing, I think it might actually benefit me more. And I think in the past, I'd only looked at it in terms of like programming. But I don't know. I'm curious if like you have any thoughts on that. Like, is it actually worth it? Like, I guess for you, it sounds like it's worth it more because of like, you know, not having the wrist strain and stuff, right? But like, let's say that wasn't an issue. do you feel like it would still be worth it from, like, say, a productivity standpoint?
I think if I didn't have the wrist, like, discomfort and stuff, I don't know if I would have been motivated to, like, go down this path. So yeah. I think it's only worth it if it's worth it to the person. Like, obviously most people haven't switched because it's not worth it to them. They don't even think to question
their
QWERTY keyboard or whatever. And that's actually fine because that means you have no problem, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe in the long run, a lot of people could benefit from it and don't realize it. But at the end of the day, if you're still able to be productive, I guess that's what's most important. And if your wrists aren't hurting, then that's just fine. But I do have a little bias where I'm like, oh, I kind of wish the world would, like, adopt Dvorak, you know, or where, because, like, it is to me a little bit funny that we have this, like, you know, rectangular shape deal that you're putting your, I mean, it's just like, it's 2023. Like, how have we not thought more creatively about how to input data into a machine with our fingers that move
in
complex ways? And it's a little bit funny, but I mean, yeah.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I've thought the same thing. And I think the answer is simply inertia, right? Like, it's just people are like, it's not worth it. Everything's already in this format. But that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't do it either. Like,
yeah, maybe a comparison would be like the metric system versus U.S. culinary.
Oh, boy.
You know, so.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I actually, a few years ago, had sort of like RSI and wrist issues as well. And the way that I solved it was essentially by changing my posture. So I was doing a lot of typing like on my laptop keyboard, and I talked to, like, I got connected via my doctor to some medical person that I consulted with, and I did my own research, and my conclusion was that maybe I need to go as far as you, but I guess I was, like, I don't know, hesitant to do that at first. And so my conclusion was, oh, if I instead have more healthy posture, which is like having my the arms be flat with, like, you know, the desk I'm at and the keyboard and some other things like that, I might not need to do these other things. And that ended up being the case. In fact, that's why I have a standing desk, is so that I could get the desk at the right height. And it actually worked. I haven't had any issues since then. The only time I ever get issues is if I'm, like, again, sitting on the couch, like, typing on my laptop keyboard and my neck is craned looking down at the screen or whatever. Which definitely wasn't a problem until I started traveling by bicycle and I just had my laptop, but I actually brought my mechanical keyboard, and that was, like, a great idea. I mean, I didn't necessarily need a mechanical keyboard, but having an external keyboard that I could, like, put lower down and have my laptop screen up higher made a big difference. But yeah, now I'm like, you're getting me into this, like, oh man, do I need to, like, go out and, like, you know, start going down this rabbit hole? Cause, like, I do a lot of writing, and that sounds nice, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. And I also use my keyboard as a mouse too. So I don't.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a portable standing desk that's much like this, like a tripod or something.
Okay.
And I've been doing that for a while too.
Before
I had this Ferris Sweep, I had a different mechanical keyboard, but I was still having wrist pain. So that's why I went deeper. But yeah, I'm basically at the point where I don't really need to use a mouse. And I also have some software on my computer that helps me, like, use Vim motions and things to basically move and navigate around other programs that you would normally just point and click.
Okay.
So that was part of it. I was kind of annoyed to have to, like, move my hand a lot. And then I found that because a mouse, it was a right-handed mouse, I was using my left hand for a lot more, and my left hand was getting more
sore.
So I'm like, I need to, you know, so that was another thing I wanted to add, but yeah.
Yeah. No, so actually I don't have it set up right now because I just sort of moved into this space, but to help with that. So I actually do a lot of things with the keyboard, not as like a way that lets me move the mouse, but doing things in Emacs and with my window manager and everything, I use keyboard shortcuts, right? And so I don't use the mouse all that much, but to help with that issue, I actually have a trackball, and I put it on the other side of my keyboard from my mouse. And so I try to like alternate between right and left hand. And so that seemed to help a lot too. And I think the trackball seemed better in general than using a regular mouse where you're like, you know, moving your arm and wrist all over, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I looked into trackballs. There's one that's a common one that's kind of a bigger normal size, but there's this other one, I forget, it might be called the Pico or something, or Pimeroni, something like that, some Italian word, but it's this small little trackball that you can mount on the keyboard. And so I was thinking of getting that and trying to use that, but you're still moving your hand and you're still, it's just on one hand. So you'd have to get two of them.
Okay.
And like, I've found that getting used to using the keyboard as a mouse like works pretty well.
So how does that work? So I'm like using my keyboard in Emacs and I don't use my mouse because I can do everything easily with the keyboard. How does that work if you're just using like a general purpose program that it doesn't have Emacs or Vim bindings?
Well, I will just say first, that's what I try to do that first is like you said, use the tiling window managers, use like Vim programs and things like that. So just to mention that at first, like there's a program called Vimium in Chrome where you can,
I've used that one.
Motions in Chrome. So, and then there's also a similar one for Mac OS, that you can do that type of same Vimium concept all over just anything on your Mac, a system level.
Okay. So is it not that you're necessarily using the keyboard to send like mouse movements, you're using the keyboard to navigate between elements on the screen. Is that right?
Well, so in this case, yes, but I also do as kind of, I guess you could say a last resort, like I do use the keyboard as a mouse, like
really
moving the mouse manually. So
how does that work?
So basically there's a mode when I hit my pointer finger and my middle finger at the same time. On one of my hands, it goes into mouse mode. And so I'm in that layer.
Yeah, mouse mode.
So basically either hand I can, it's basically similar as Vim, but I can go up, down, right, left with the home row.
Uh-huh.
Or I can go like scroll up with the middle finger going up or scroll down. And then you can scroll right and left. So I'm moving.
How does that work? Like, let's say I want to move the mouse really far and then I'm trying to hit something really precise and I need to like slow down.
Well, it can get a little annoying at first, but like as you get used to it, I'm able to aim better. But
still
sometimes I find myself, that's why I try to not use
buttons.
I still have my trackpad when I do. And then I do also still, but I don't set up my mouse anymore. But basically, to answer your question, I have the top corners of like the pointer finger. Those are like for acceleration times two. So you can just zip your mouse all the way across. And then the key next to that is like a level one. So it's accelerating.
Yeah.
So you can control your movement that way. And I found like I'm pretty used to it where it's sometimes I find myself using it when I don't need to because I'm pretty comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to use it less and less.
Yeah. So I actually... This has been maybe like 10 years now or something, but I actually at one point had my system set up with a window manager called Stump Window Manager. It's a tiling-based window manager, of course, written in Lisp. It's written in Common Lisp, right? Yeah, of course. So I had that and I had Emacs and some other things like the extensions for like the browser to navigate by mouse. And I did basically, or navigate by keyboard. I basically did everything by keyboard. So I've been there. I think at this point I've gotten like somewhat lazy and I'm like, I'm just using that for the things that I spend most of my time in, which is Emacs. But I do think there would be benefit to sort of doing it more, especially like, if I'm doing a lot of like web browsing for research and stuff, I think that would really pay off. Like, you know, I think it makes sense. Now we know mouse mode. Dun, dun, dun. don't let the cats know, right? So I think that brings us, you know, nicely into the next thing I was curious about. So what editor do you use when you're writing code?
Okay, so I've recently started using NeoVim. I also am comfortable with VS Code, but I don't feel like a cool kid for using VS Code. I would feel
Why not? That's what all the cool kids use. What's wrong with you?
I know, it's super popular. I would feel the coolest, honestly, if I could use Emacs, but I'm not there. I haven't spent enough time with it. But yeah, I really like NeoVim. Well, I just like Vim and Vim Motions.
Yeah.
And so I think NeoVim's kind of cool because it seems to have a little more features that you can hook into with the plugin system and stuff, even though you have to configure everything. But the idea that you can write stuff in Lua instead of just being limited to Vim script with regular Vim, seems nice, but I'm still so new. I haven't really done a big project with NeoVim yet. I've just like kind of messed around with it as an editor and configured it in a pretty minimalistic way that seems to be pretty good. So
yeah, well, I'll be honest, I actually have some bindings in my Emacs set up to match Vim bindings.
Yeah, don't they call that, isn't there evil mode in Emacs?
Yeah, no, I don't do that, but
once I found out about that, that's when because between Vim and Emacs, I really like Vim Motions, and the Emacs, the control, having to hold the control key all the time kind of was a big deterrent for me. But
So what I do is all my keyboards are set so that the caps lock key is the control key. Mm-hmm. And that basically eliminated all the problems I had with having to hold down the key. When I was having to hold down control key, like the actual control key, that was a problem after a while. But after I mapped it to caps lock, it just isn't. Maybe because it's, you know, on the home row type of thing or whatever. I don't know. But
what I like about Vim is you don't have to hold down any key to move stuff. You basically would be in a certain mode, so you would toggle.
Right.
So that's, I mean, on my keyboard, I have the control key mapped to the ring fingers one below. So it would, I think it would be like on a QWERTY keyboard, like X and then like the comma. And
yeah,
but when you hold that, it's the control key. So I don't mind holding the control key, but I don't want to have to hold it every time I move my cursor. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I think this is also an interesting discussion too, because a feature that I use heavily in Emacs that I haven't really, maybe it exists elsewhere. I don't know. Maybe you know about it, but I like to do what's called like structured editing. And so in Lisp, we use something called paredit. But there's similar facilities for like JavaScript and other languages. And it allows you to move the cursor via essentially structures at a time. So there's a keyboard shortcut that will move me to the beginning of the current function or to the previous function or move me to the next token in the line or a keyboard shortcut that moves me forward one word or three words or whatever. I guess it's not really words when it comes to like structured programming. It's more about navigating via the program's structure itself. And so I find that sort of helps cover that whole, like, you know, having to hold down control. And like, if you don't know how to do that, you're just like holding down control and hitting N and P and whatever, like a billion times to move the cursor. And I think that is also, pretty annoying. I don't know. Have you ever had experience with that type of editing?
Well, there might be like something, the way it's implemented in Emacs that I maybe don't know fully. But I mean, in Vim, maybe you're aware, like you can navigate all sorts of different ways like that. Like you can go forward 3 words, 10 words, same with lines.
Yeah.
So go forward like by paragraph, which it'll basically just look for a period and it'll go.
Right. And I'm talking about like taking that to the next level. Like, does it understand your programming language?
So I don't think it does.
But yeah.
Like in NeoVim, they use like LSPs for like different things.
But okay. LSP like, mode. Yeah.
That's more like syntax highlighting and, you know, linting and
But that can provide the editor with the same information it needs to do structured editing. Yeah.
So that would be cool. I mean, maybe there's a way to do it, but I know you can like go to definition and you can do all that in NeoVim, but I haven't actually looked at where you're navigating your code based on not just like looking for a curly brace to go to the end of that you know, open, but actually saying, no, this is, we understand what your function definition is written as, and we're going to the end of that. So,
I love it. It's,
it's cool.
In Lisp, that thing in Emacs, it's super dialed. And like, not only can you move the cursor that way, but you can actually manipulate the source code in that way. So you can be like, I want to move this block of code inside an if statement. Like, let's say you have your code and you're like, oh, I want to add an if statement, or you want to move a block of code from somewhere else inside the if statement. You can do what's called the slurp. It's like, and it'll slurp it into it. So it's just one keyboard shortcut that moves it in between the opening and closing if and end if, or, you know, brackets or whatever it happens to be, right? So it takes it even to the next level. It's not just moving the cursor. It's like moving the structure of your code around. And it can do way more things than just like moving stuff in and out of blocks. I don't know. I have you heard of anything like that or seen that before?
No, I mean, if I understand it correctly, no, I don't think so. I mean, it sounds like it understands basically the code in a way, and it's have a lot of powerful stuff related to that. I mean, my closest, it's not a close thing, but you can, you know, highlight text and, you know, cut it and paste it, or in like, you can move it up, you know?
But yeah.
Like, as far as actually saying, no, move it to this if statement, and or I don't know if you're saying make it wrap, like make a new if statement that just is created and wraps around it.
So yeah, you could think of it like this. Let's say I've got a block of code and I decide I want it to be inside an if statement, right? So
like an existing if statement or create.
Let's say you're creating a new one. Okay. It doesn't really matter, but so let's say
it would just make an if statement surrounding it.
That you can also do that. But in this case, let's just say I type out like if I type out my condition, right? And then I have like the opening bracket, right? I can hit a keyboard shortcut that will essentially, you could think of it as adding the closing bracket for that if statement after my block of code for me. Like I don't have to navigate down to the end of my block of code and add that bracket, right?
Yeah.
But it can also do like the reverse. I can be inside that block of code and be like, oh, I don't want this if state, this block of code to be in the if statement. I can hit a keyboard shortcut that moves that block of code outside of the if statement. I can move it before or after or
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, this is partly why I think, you know, in the long run, I'd like to learn Emacs or something, is because it's almost an operating system, right?
Oh, definitely it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, do you ever find, is there a bloat with it? Do you feel like, oh, Emacs is too heavy? It's too much. It's too big.
I mean, like,
does it slow you down? Does it slow down your machine?
The only time I've ever had that happen is if I like write really bad Elisp code myself or something.
I see.
But even that is less of a problem. I haven't even set this up yet, but newer versions of Emacs can compile everything now, and so it runs even faster. But no, the funny thing is, whenever I have to use like VS Code or, oh, I had to use Android Studio the other day when I was working on an Android app, and oh my God, those programs are so resource heavy and so laggy and so slow. I'm like tearing my head out. I'm like, how the heck do people use these things? Like Emacs, it takes like maybe like 40 megabytes of RAM when I've got 300 buffers loaded, you know, 300 files open. It's using like, you know, barely any RAM, and everything I do is instant, you know. I get like Android Studio was driving me up a wall. Like trying to do anything in it was just grinding my computer to a halt. I was like, I don't know, what am I missing? Are there like so many amazing features in these programs that it's worth being slow? I don't know. Have you had that experience where you're like, oh, NeoVim is so fast and VS Code is slow, or am I just like doing it wrong?
Yeah, partly in VS Code, that was one little thing. Well, not little thing, but one big thing that made me want to look elsewhere. It was also this whole trying to be mouse free and, getting into versions, but I know like Vim run, I mean, VS Code runs on like Electron, and I know that comes with limitations and it can be buggy. And I was wondering at first if I was just using my plugins wrong or if I was basically had my settings like in VS Code set up wrong.
Yeah.
But I think some of that might've been true, but also I found that happening when it was just pretty clean. Like sometimes it would run slow.
You'd be going along and you'd hit the period, you know, and it's going to like pop up that menu with like suggestions, but like you don't need the suggestions. You're going to type like three characters after it and you're just typing through and then it's like, you know, and you're like, no, stop. Yeah. Like, yeah, that just drives me up a wall. Yeah. So, okay. So it's not just me.
Yeah. I know. Isn't Xcode like huge? It's like last time I checked, it was like 16 gigabytes or something just to download.
Yeah. I mean, but I haven't used it as much, but I don't know that I've run into a situation where Xcode felt slow once it was running, but I haven't used it that much.
I haven't really used it much, but I downloaded it once on Axe before I knew that kind of a long time ago. And I was like, ooh, I regret it.
Oh yeah. It's huge. I don't know why it's so big, but yeah, there's, but yeah, anyways, I think you were asking about like, do I ever feel slowed down by Emacs? And there is one case where I do, and that is, a lot of times I want to edit like a text file in the terminal and my default is to use Emacs, but my Emacs has a really extensive startup file that I've customized over the years that does a whole bunch of stuff. And so it takes a few seconds to start up, like maybe 2 seconds or something. And so when I want to make a quick edit on a text file, I have to remember to type dash Q, you know, so it doesn't load my, you know, custom config file, in which case it loads instantaneously. But yeah, that's about the only thing is my bloated, you know, startup file.
I see. So you basically spend half a second typing dash Q or
one
millisecond, but you save a whole 1.75 seconds.
I mean, to me, it seems like a lot. I don't know. I fire up like Android Studio or VS Code and I have to wait a lot longer. So I don't know how people do that either, but you know, or like the other thing that drives me up a wall with those programs is like, I normally have my Emacs set up with like 4 to 6, what we call buffers open at a time, which you can kind of think as a window into a file or even just a file. And so like, the way that, and so I can see all my files like at once, and I probably have like 200 to 400 files open in my Emacs at once. And I have them sort of organized and it's easy to switch between them. But then I'll be like working with somebody on like VS Code or something, and they can't like do that. Like they get too many tabs going or something, and it either gets slow or they can't find it, or I don't know. Maybe I'm just like too far down the like evangelist Emacs, you know, rabbit hole here. But yeah,
I've never had to open more than maybe 10 files at once, so. I've basically in NeoVim, I like the flexibility. Like it feels like you can program different things to, kind of have keyboard shortcuts set to different files open, but that's the next level to me is having 200 files open. Like you can't just navigate your file structure, or your project to get the file. You have to have it open and know where it is. That's a lot to keep track of, but that's, I don't know. That's just kind of new.
Well, so for me, it's not that I'm necessarily working with them all at once, but that covers, you know, I only close my Emacs window maybe once, like every 6 months when I reboot to get the latest kernel update, you know? And so that covers, you know, maybe 10 to 15 files across, you know, 10 different projects, So I don't have to go find the most commonly used files for whatever project I'm working on. I just type, you know, control X, B and start typing the name of the file and it pops it right up. So I don't know, for me, that's nice. But the big thing is I was really getting at is the whole like thing that I struggled with in VS Code was it wouldn't let me open the same file in at like two different spots on the screen.
Right.
So in Emacs, I prefer putting everything in one file. And in Emacs, it's super easy to search through that file. So I add like little like tags throughout my file. So it'll be like, oh, I want to jump to the place where all my React components are defined, or I want to jump to where all my utilities are defined. I type Control S and I start typing UTIL, and hit enter, and it jumps me to that spot. So I end up with a file that's like 5,000 lines long. That's my entire program. And I open that same file up multiple times on my window, and they each have their own cursor and they're each in their own spot. So I can work on and see the code all at once. And I found that actually this caused a lot of issues on one team I was on, because everyone else was using VS Code and they kept moving my files into a bunch of smaller files. And I was like, why are you guys doing this? Now you have to like find the file, then find the code within the file if you're looking for stuff. And it turned out it's because VS Code doesn't actually let you see things next to each other unless they're in different files.
Well, I mean, I know there's a way you can split your screen. Like basically you can open the same file in two different, like in a split.
Yep.
So in that, I'm not sure about.
I mean, maybe it's
in a different window. Maybe you can. I just haven't done that much. But
the problem is, so you can do that. But when I was, what it seemed like the cursors were tied between them. So if you move the cursor in one, it'll scroll the other, or move the cursor in the other. So if you want jump back and forth between editing both of them, you have to keep moving the cursor back and forth.
Was it? Oh,
within the file.
Wait. So you're saying. Hold on. So you're not saying that. So let's say you have a split screen. You're typing in one screen, the other screen. You were saying you weren't able to like view a different part of the code than where your cursor was on the left screen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think, was it a while ago? Was it
maybe like a year ago?
Only a year. Okay. I don't know.
2 years ago. I don't know.
I feel like this
year they've improved it.
I feel like this year I've done things where I had a file open and I looked at a certain part of the code, and then I changed a different area of the code over here.
Okay.
Didn't move, but
so they've improved that.
perhaps. Yeah. I would say though, I know there's a lot more powerful stuff you can do in other editors than like VS Code's window management's. Like, I think I wouldn't argue that it's definitely more limited.
Yeah. And I think that also, an interesting thing I've noticed about people that use VS Code, and I don't know if you've noticed this or maybe you've set up your NeoVim in a certain way, but a lot of people seem to rely really heavily on it sort of like auto-completing things for them. And that's something that I actually have configured my Emacs to do, but I sort of unconfigured it because I feel like if I'm forced to actually type things out, I learn them better.
Yeah.
And what I find really fascinating watching somebody using VS Code is they rely so heavily on their editor to do everything for them. They don't actually know the program as well. I'll be like, oh yeah, it's this function, right? And they'll be like, I don't know. Let me like start typing and see what it tells me. I see.
Yeah, that's... I definitely have heard people say when you're learning, it's really important to type stuff out, but it's kind of cool to hear that you keep that mentality almost just continuously, like when you're programming. So,
yeah, I mean, and I think that gets into a much bigger topic beyond just editors, in that I feel like the mentality around programming has really more heavily shifted away from the like RTFM, like read the manual, learn how it works, and then go implement it into a, I don't understand what's going on, I'm going to put it in Stack Overflow or now ChatGPT. And there's very little like critical thinking going on. I don't know if you tend towards one thing or the other, if you've witnessed this before as well, but I think it's kind of the same thing where I'm like, it's not that I don't look up stuff on Stack Overflow, or I don't really find that much use for ChatGPT yet, but in that sense. But like, it's not that I don't do that, but at the same time, when I don't understand something, my tendency is to be like, okay, let me find the man page for this or the documentation. I'm going to learn the documentation, learn and understand why it's doing this, and then I can move forward. But I feel like it's that sort of same mentality where I'm like, yeah, I might have to spend longer typing this thing out because it's not auto-completing it for me. But I feel like in the long run, I'm able to more effectively do my work because I understand things at like a deeper level.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been getting into programming more so as the main focus only recently. So I guess I've seen like all this, you know, with the manual pages for different, like, let's say if you're learning like bash or shell stuff and then kind of any of that, as well as like Vim. One kind of interesting thing that I think, so on the Stack Overflow like survey of like popular tools and stuff, I think NeoVim is like increasing in popularity. And so I think there's a lot of these kind of people on social media that are like really promoting it. And so NeoVim seems to put a lot of like effort into their documentation, or at least
Vim
has good documentation.
Yeah.
So a lot of these guys are saying like read the manual.
Yeah.
Like, I know for me, like learning NeoVim, and Vim, like the manual has been really helpful for me. And I think, so maybe that's an interesting, like kind of getting a trending thing of like, okay, bringing that back, like read the manual. But
yeah. And cause like, did you ever read the VS Code manual? Right.
Right. So that's the thing. I would go into like the website for VS Code and try to read their like how stuff works. But I found it sometimes to not be as great as I, or at least for me, it seemed like it was harder to find the info that I needed. But at the same time, I was also, when I was more learning, I guess, VS Code, I was kind of newer to programming. So maybe I was just new, but,
And that's, so what I will often tell people is, yeah, sure, start with VS Code when you're just learning, because I want the focus to be on learning the programming, but just to get the excitement of making a working program and not worry about memorizing or not only memorizing, but like spending hours digging into the documentation. Right. But I also wonder if there's a point where you're like, okay, I'm sort of beyond that stage. Maybe I would benefit from spending more time learning things at a deeper level and focusing less on, having things happen for me and understanding how to do them myself. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm just like this old school gray beard that's wasting my time reading manuals. I don't know, but like, I'm just kind of curious, like I haven't used NeoVim, but does it do a lot of this like autocomplete and all that for you?
It definitely has all those features that like the completion and I guess snippets and things like that. You would just need to configure it with, you know, like a plugin in VS Code. Usually it's a little more, you download the plugin and it kind of just works. In NeoVim, there's a little more configuration, but that comes with, you can be flexible about it. But I think, you know, and you can use GitHub Copilot within it or whatever. So you can,
yeah,
if you want, you can, you know, have it autocomplete for you if you want to.
Yeah.
And I also like that.
But do you?
I do some autocompletion. Yeah. When I'm learning stuff, like for instance, like I've shared with you about like Rust, like I was like doing a little Rust thing and they kind of walk you through it and it's intended to learn, you know, teach you some of the principles of it. And instead of just only building the app. So I make it a point to like type things out to get the muscle memory and to reinforce some of the learning. But if I'm just writing, some other, I don't know, like React application that I'm more comfortable in, like I don't always force myself to like complete, like type everything manually, but sometimes I do. But like I don't feel like I, like if I start to not be able to write basic syntax or understand the thing, then it's kind of a flag for me, like
I didn't say this earlier, but it actually goes deeper for me. So another reason why I try not to use those types of features is because to me, it sort of becomes a sort of forced way of realizing my code could maybe be improved. So if I end up typing the same thing over and over again and it's like really long or whatever, it's like, oh, maybe what I need to do is think about a different way to structure this. Mm-hmm. And it's like sort of this like forced reminder there. And I don't know, maybe I'm just like being a masochist or something, right? Like, I don't know.
That's a really interesting, almost maybe side effect of something, because I haven't really thought about that. But that does sound really beneficial. If you catch yourself typing the same thing, you realize, okay, this is, I'm repeating myself.
Yeah.
And if you're auto-completing, you may not catch that, right? So
yeah, and I think I saw like when I'd watch people program in like VS Code and stuff and using all the snippets and all these other features, it didn't seem to register with their brain what they were actually doing, because they weren't really doing it. It was kind of being done for them.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's just one of those things that, I don't know, maybe I'm like a dinosaur and just, you know, wasting my time and it isn't worth it. But at the same time, I feel like it kind of is, because then I'm like, oh, you know, maybe there's a pattern here. Maybe I recognize that pattern more easily or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But anyways, so that's editors, and you talked about Rust, and I thought, you know, maybe we could, I could learn more about it. So how much have you done in Rust?
A little bit. So I've like started to go through the Rust book, and there's like part of, I don't know what you would call it, but like I think there's some University Brown something that has like a quiz integrated with the Rust book. So I'll kind of use that as a means to learn, kind of reinforce. I haven't gotten very far through. I've only gotten through the first few chapters, and then I've started a project where you build an email server. It's
Awesome.
It's a prod.
Yeah.
It's a book, written by this guy. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but it's like Luca or Lucas something. And anyway, it seems like a really great book, and I've only gotten through the first like almost three chapters.
Okay.
So yeah, I haven't been like super like only focused on Rust, but I've been interested enough to like start learning it, start exploring it. And
so why I know you've done JavaScript, right? Yeah. Why Rust?
So I have a background that's more like, so electrical engineering is more my background. And the first programming language, so I learned Python and then C. And I found that when I learned the C programming language, that's where I started to really get a grasp for, okay, this is doing with programming. Like it started to click. I started to really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I know that was like lower level than Python. So basically in my web development journey, you know, shifting into that, I always had in the back of my mind, like, you know, I want to explore sort of the deeper stuff and maybe a little bit lower level stuff eventually, because maybe I'll like that and maybe it could be, you know,
yeah,
there's more.
So it's more like you want to get into lower level stuff,
yeah,
and you've done C. So why don't you just keep doing C? Why are you picking up Rust?
Well, so what I noticed with Rust was two things. Number one, in that Stack Overflow survey, supposedly since like 2016 or something, it always comes out on top as like people saying this is their favorite programming language.
Oh, at least the people who answered this.
And so that caught my attention. And the fact that I kept seeing in the modern JavaScript community, a lot of tools being written or rewritten in Rust.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really interesting. So I thought it could be something like, of course, if this is everybody's, it's not everybody, but if it's like everybody's favorite, then maybe I would like it too. And I, you know, I ran into some pain points with JavaScript, and it was like, I chose it more out of like the utility of it, and like the, it's, and I shared this before as well, but like it seemed like a lower barrier to entry. But after all that, I kind of wanted to open up to like what would be interesting in the long run. And I thought Rust being still sort of niche, but trending and growing, it could be an opportunity, like a good space to get into.
Yeah.
With more opportunities coming. And
so how do you feel so far?
I mean, it's pretty new. Like, I think what I've come to realize,
like, but I mean, have you had like those like aha, like, oh wow, that's really neat, or like,
so when I started learning Rust, I think just my impression, just reading the Rust book and stuff, is like, okay, wow, these people like seem to have really clear thinking. They seem to have really intentional ways that they've like made decisions about how they built this language. It was just, you know, the community seemed happy about Rust. It seems like in the book and everything, it kind of, it just seemed to reflect that in my experience. And then following people on, different social.
Yeah. Platforms. Is there like anything specific where you've been like, oh, that's a really cool way they do XYZ or something?
I don't know. I don't necessarily think of anything like off the top of my head that was like that thing. But
I mean, I know you've mentioned like air handling before. Have you learned about that yet?
Not much. I mean, the first few chapters of Rust, it's very basic.
Okay.
It's
more
just like syntax stuff and,
yeah. I mean, I don't really know any Rust, so I'm just curious,
you know? I know some of the overarching principles, like to me. So one of the things that I really, that seems to make sense to me is like having a really strong, like compiler where it's going to catch your errors and give you really meaningful error messages and try to do that really well.
It
really cares about that. And
so exactly like C.
I haven't done any of that with C.
No, I mean, C is C's notorious for, well, more C++, but yeah, oh man, it's like, especially you get into C++, like templates and stuff, and you might spend a day trying to decipher that error message, you know? So sounds like a focus of Rust is fixing that problem.
Yeah. I think like the mentality is you want to, if your program's broken, it shouldn't run. Like, and I think, you know, trying to build programs in that way seems to, like, I could see why people would like that experience. Because
That's interesting. So that's the, so is this like sort of, it provides more facilities upfront at like compile time to detect potential bugs in your code?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I think, I mean, it makes the trade-off is that it's slower compile time and that it's kind of like maybe an analogy like is instead of if you only just need a box, Rust kind of assumes it needs to be like a steel box, whereas other languages, it maybe you only need a cardboard box.
So
it might take you longer to build it, but it's going to be, you know, more error, less error prone and stuff.
Makes sense. Have you ever heard of design by contract before?
No.
It reminds me of that. I don't actually know if it's the same, but like, the idea behind design by contract is like, let's say you wrote a function, we'll just say in JavaScript, and the function is called add one. You pass in a number and it adds one to it and returns it. Like really simple, right? Design by contract, you would put what's called like pre and post invariants. And so you would say for this function, like you'd write this kind of in a design by contract language or whatever. And you would say, we have our one argument and it's supposed to be a number, right? So in our design by contract system, in our pre-invariant, we say this argument must be a number. And maybe your system can't handle numbers larger than number dot maximum JavaScript integer, right? So that would be part of your contract is whatever value is passed into here cannot be larger than, you know, 10 million or whatever it happens to be, or it must be between 0 and 10 million. So it must be of type number. It must be between 0 and 10 million. And then you have your post invariance, which is whatever value gets returned must be between 0 and 10 million, and it must be a number. So it kind of reminds me of that, of like creating a system where and design by contract isn't necessarily happening at compile time. You can do some of this at compile time. You can also do it at runtime, you know, or both. But it reminds me of that where you're like taking a much more like explicit approach to specifying the inputs and outputs to your program. And you know, when it comes to errors, if you're doing design by contract, you'd be like, oh, this function can throw this error and only this error or something like this type of thing. I don't know. Does that sound kind of similar to you?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think about design by contract? Does it sound interesting?
I mean, it sounds interesting, but I don't know if I have enough depth of knowledge of the topic to really, because like all I think of is just like, for instance, why people might be drawn to TypeScript or something that over JavaScript is because they like specifying the return types or the actual types of your whatever you're using. So, I mean, but I think there's more to it.
Yeah, design by contract can be super detailed. Like, you know, this is only allowed, to take these arguments, and each argument, not only do you specify the type, but maybe ranges or whatever. Like, it's just more specific than type. It's like, types are just kind of a broad general thing, but you can be way more specific, right? Like, why stop at types? Why not have more constraints, you know? And so, like, yeah, anyways, I find it interesting, and that it, like, to me, design by contract, it's kind of like my approach to TypeScript, you know, where I don't think there's a lot of inherent value to doing everything in TypeScript, but if I have a well-developed piece of code and I want to make it more robust, I might take some of the critical paths and convert them to TypeScript, you know? What I actually do in Lisp is I will use design by contract in more critical parts, you know, where I'm like, okay, I want this code to be super robust and not crash, or I want to know if I change anything that could potentially break this. I want to know it at compile time, you know, so I'll use design by contract in those cases to really nail it down, type of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Fun little tidbit. I do remember learning it in school, and I think I'd actually taught myself some of it beforehand, but man, it was like so boring.
So is that where you first learned of it, was in school?
I think I had kind of gotten familiar with it by teaching myself. Like, I saw it online, but actually it was one of the few things I did learn more in my computer science degree. Like, I had this professor, I remember they were from Iran, and I just remember they're like super precise about everything. And I thought it was so fitting that they were so into like design by contract, you know, like to them, everything was like super precise. And I don't know, I found it really boring, the actual class, but like the concept itself, I was like, oh, this actually makes a lot of sense, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Cause I think sometimes when the class is boring, or when you have a like hard time with it, you know, a teacher, then maybe you're less drawn to a subject.
Yeah.
So there must be something about like this topic, because I mean, if you're drawn to it, what is it called again? Smart
design by contract.
I was thinking smart contract. Yeah. Design by contract. Then there must be something about it that, I mean, is powerful. Cause yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's basically like, more explicitly stating the parameters or the sort of bounds of your inputs and your outputs. And it's interesting too, because it sort of acts as documentation. So like, I go to the add one function, it's like, oh, I didn't have to write in a comment, this takes one argument that's of type number, whatever. It's like, it's literally written explicitly right there, you know? Yeah, so I don't know, fun little thing. You know, it makes me think of another fun technique, and this relates more back to like Emacs and stuff, but have you ever heard of literate programming? I know I'm like throwing a bunch of stuff in here, but like...
No.
I don't really expect you to know. Most people don't know, but it's like, yeah, most people don't know design by contract. Most people don't know literate programming, but I don't know. I think it's fun to like learn these things, yeah. Even if I don't really get to use them much. I feel like it's, you know, it's like one of those things that it's like someday maybe I'm in a situation where I'm like, oh, this thing would be useful here, you know? And
I would hope most programmers are literate.
So literate programming is where you essentially write out in human language what your program does before you really write the source code. But then the source code is embedded in this larger English document. So in literate programming, you would write like, so I wanted to create a program that allows me to generate a random number. And I thought the way to do this would be to create a function that takes a number as an argument. And I feel like this number should only be between 10 and 100 for the reasons that my hardware has limitations. And I want this to be able to run on machines with very little memory. And so you basically write out all of your reasons for creating the code the way you did. And so then you might write out your function, but your function is like 5% of what you've written. And in Emacs, there's like a whole thing called like literate programming web web mode where you can like weave together this code within your massive document of like human language. And I find it's just a really, even if I don't use it all the time, it's really kind of interesting as like a brain exercise too, because it like forces you to actually verbalize what you're programming. I don't know. Does any of that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it just sounds like it's similar to just programming something with a ton of comments.
Yeah.
Like a certain style or approach.
Yeah. I think it's like a much more extreme version, where it's not even, where I guess where the structure of your program is based on the English language version that you're presenting. And so,
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So you might, if you're writing this as a program, the syntax of JavaScript might, for example, require your function to be declared after it's or before it's used or something like that. JavaScript doesn't actually have that limitation, but you know, there are limitations, like you can't call this before it's used or whatever. But maybe in your English language version, you want to talk about how you wanted to make it a certain way and you want to refer to this bit of code before it would be legally allowed to be used. And so you're actually using this sort of meta language to be like, oh yeah, we actually put this bit of code that I'm talking about up here further down here inside this, you know, class definition or something, you know? So that's kind of where it's probably a different level than just like adding comments to a piece of source code. I don't know if that makes any sense, but yeah.
How much have you done, like explored this or?
I've written some programs in it, yeah. And I think actually, I would like to see more programs written in it. I think it really pays off. Like, it's one of those things that I think when you're working in a team, or if you're working on code that like you don't touch for like a year and you come back to it, it's like super valuable because now you can just look at everything, all your thoughts. And like on a team, I found it's really interesting because like, when you just get somebody's code, you make a lot of assumptions about why they wrote something the way they did, you know? And then when you operate based on those assumptions and they happen to be wrong, that's where you start introducing like bugs you weren't expecting. You're like, oh, why is they doing it this way? Like, what the heck? I don't understand. And then you go talk to the person. They're like, oh, it does it this way for this reason. You're like, oh, that makes sense. I never thought of that, you know? But with the literate programming, it's like reading a book that explains the program and it's just all right there. And, you know, so it sort of makes communicating within teams a lot more forced, I guess, you know.
Did you find that it took a lot more time up front to write the program or that it was annoying?
It does take more time up front, yeah.
Did you find that it bothered you to explain everything? Yeah.
I think where it got annoying was more when I was like doing refactoring and stuff.
Right.
The upfront part, I enjoy writing. And so I think maybe I'm more naturally inclined to it, you know?
Yeah.
If you hate writing and you love just writing code, you're probably going to hate it. But for me, it was like, oh, this is fun. I would like actually like sort of make it like a story, even like tell a story about how it works. So it's like you get entertained while you're reading somebody's source code, wow. You know?
Nice.
And, but then you'd go to like refactor it and you're like, oh no, now I got to like rewrite all this code. And that kind of got annoying. And yeah.
I wonder if it gets weird when someone refactors a part of the code and then another part was written, like the English part was written assuming this part worked.
Yeah, yeah.
So it now refers to that. Like basically it's...
That's what I'm saying. That's where it gets hard because yeah, to do it right, you'd have to go and like rewrite all of that and stuff. Yeah.
You have to know, like I wonder if there's a way to know what types of, I guess, little dependencies are within. Because like,
yeah,
you know, if you...
I mean, it describes all of that. So you can do it. It's just a lot of work, you know? Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, Evan, now that we've made enemies with half of the programmers out there and you need to walk around worrying about a pitchfork showing up behind you, what do you say we sort of wind things down here?
I'd say that sounds good, but that sounds bad.
Sounds good. Well, thank you all so much for joining us, and we really don't care. I don't care what editor you use and, you know, what keyboard you use, but I thought it was interesting to just discuss it and sort of learn more about what the options. I don't know. What do you think, Evan?
I don't care what editor you use ultimately, but I definitely care if you use Dvorak.
All right. You have it. Well, thank you, Evan, for joining me on the show today. And thank you all for listening and supporting the show. We really appreciate all of you. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of your day. Bye.
Bye.